The open mind, free to examine, to question, to disagree. Our subject today, is there a moral crisis in America today? Your host on The Open Mind is Eric F. Goldman, professor of history at Princeton University and author of Rendezvous with Destiny and the Crucial Decade.
Good afternoon. Television has become so commonplace a part of our life today that we sometimes forget how really new it is. After all, as you recall, it was only at the time of the Kefauver hearings in 1950 that television really began moving up out of the bar rooms and into the family living room. It was just 6 years after the Kefauver hearings in May 1956 that this program, The Open Mind, was born. Since I am a relative newcomer to the Open Mind and had nothing to do with its earlier period, I'm privileged to mention what a breath of fresh air it was in the mass media of that day. It was totally ungimmicked, just four men sitting around a plain wooden table trying to talk sense about something they considered unimportant. It was totally unrehearsed. It was unabashedly intellectual, always preferring the expert and the egghead to the merely glib person. And it was quite adventurous, often venturing into fields and subjects which most of the mass media at that time were shying away from. Well, now the Open Mind is a big boy. It's 4 years old, a ripe old age for a program in a field where obsolescence is so rapid as that of television. And it goes on in its usual way of following its well-established tradition. For maintaining that tradition, for making the continuance of the program possible, for bringing about such a large part of whatever values this program achieves, there are so many people who must be thanked, people that you never see. So many people, and my time here, of course, is so short. Let me cite just two who have been particularly vital. Mr. William N. Davidson, Vice President of NBC and General Manager of WRCA-TV, a strong and consistent friend of the Open Mind, and the producer of this program, Mrs. Eleanor S. Rigger, a young woman of uncommon astuteness, a world of imagination, and a dogged dedication to the highest standards of public affairs programs. Now quickly to the program of today. The moral situation in the United States, the cheating we read about on all sides, and the widespread feeling that we face something of a moral crisis in this country. Our panel, to my right, Mr. A.H. Raskin, whom we regularly read in the New York Times on his labor reporting. In the center, Mr. Reinhold Niebuhr, certainly one of the world's foremost theologians, and also what I would much rather introduce him as, certainly one of America's most beloved figures. And across from me, Mr. William Atwood, foreign affairs editor of Look magazine and the author of an extremely level-headed and penetrating article in Look on the subject under discussion today. May I ask you gentlemen to begin this discussion by a general comment on a quotation from Mr. John Steinbeck. Mr. Steinbeck writing to Adlai Stevenson several months ago. He said, "If I wanted to destroy a nation, I would give it too much, and I would have it on its knees, miserable, greedy, and sick. On all levels today, American society is rigged. I am troubled by the cynical immorality of my country. It cannot survive on this basis." Mr. Raskin, would you open, please?
I don't feel realistically that we are as sunk in moral degradation as Mr. Steinbeck apparently believes. On the other hand, I do agree that we have a genuine moral crisis in this country, and I think the reason is that we have exalted materialistic goals, and we now live in an era in which we see science reaching forward, racing forward, giving us much greater opportunity for ennobling and enriching life, and at the same time, we're oppressed with the sense that science also has made it possible for us to destroy ourselves, and we don't know and we fear that we haven't got the moral wisdom to deal with that problem. Truthfully, I think our social invention has just been left stagnant, and as a result, we really are in a sad condition.
Mr. Niebuhr,
well,
I would agree
with Mr. Raskin that Mrs. Steinbeck's indictment is excessive, but we've got to take it seriously. But I am a little troubled about calling this a moral crisis, because it is a moral crisis, but there's a greater crisis in the political field, in our relationship to the world, for instance, in our relationship to the nuclear dilemma, which has moral overtones. So I'd like to make the distinction of clear moral issues, and I'd say the clear moral issues are where the standards are generally accepted, maybe not practiced, but generally accepted, like honesty and fidelity in marriage, which Mr. Atwood has dealt with in his Look magazine, and the overtones of morality in politics, which is quite different, because there you have the ambiguity of the political order, that you don't have a clear goal, but you have several, or not a clear principle, several principles are in conflict with each other, and you also have the problem of means and ends. Every political problem is partly a technical problem, partly a moral problem. So that this there may be a greater crisis in this field, but it's not as clear-cut as the moral crisis in the field that Mr. Atwood has been talking about.
Mr. Atwood?
Well, I also agree that John Steinbeck was probably talking more as a dramatist than an objective reporter. I think there has been a change in our moral standards, maybe even a slackening. But the very fact that people are concerned about it and confused about it, perhaps, shows certainly that they're not cynical about it. The very fact that we're sitting here discussing it, and in the course of the survey we made, we found everybody very willing to discuss it. They're upset. I think we have a changing code of ethics in this country. I think possibly something better will come out of it. So we are, in a sense, in a crisis. But it's a crisis of
Well, before flux. We get to that changing code of ethics, I wonder if we don't want to say a word about this distinction which Mr. Niebuhr has made between what might be called political or public morality, the great public questions and their connection with morality, and the more private morality. Are we to assume these two things are separate?
Well, they're not absolutely separate, but they're distinct. Because in the political morality, you don't have as clear-cut issues as in the private morality, because at least in the examples that Mr. Atwood chooses, you've got clear-cut standards, honesty and fidelity, which have been accepted through all the ages and are now partly defied, or considerably defied. That's private morality. Now, public morality is maybe even more important, because we're living in a collectivist age. But you can't make an absolute distinction, because in public morality, Mr. Raskin will have, I think, something more to say about the morality of the Teamsters Union, for instance. And now there, the standards are clear. That's a matter of honesty and dishonesty. The standards are fairly clear in the race issue, and yet they're defied. Well, when we get to the international field, nuclear dilemma, foreign aid, you've got a great crisis.
Let's try to pin this down. Take labor as an example. Is this a public question, a private question, or both?
Well, I think it's a compound of both, and I think that to a certain extent there is an artificiality in attempting to divorce the cynicism with which we feel ourselves surrounded in terms of our day-to-day life from our overall doubts about our ability to manage our affairs sanely in this world in which we have the capacity for total obliteration. I think that the situation that exists in labor is disturbing in two respects. First, there's the dismaying fact that in what ought to be an agency of social idealism, of greater social justice, you find the penetration of the Becks, the Hoffas, the Johnny Dios, and so on. Now, that isn't new. We had Al Capone running the labor movement in Chicago more than a quarter century ago. You had Lepke and Garrah here in New York. So that part is not so new, even though in terms of extent it may be and probably is worse today than it was. The thing that's tragic to me is that our labor movement did try to grapple with this problem, I think tried to grapple with it intelligently, forcefully, and with a genuine recognition that if there were pockets of pollution within labor, it would tear down the whole structure of labor. And the things that labor did failed, and the end result is that labor is now sort of throwing in the sponge and saying, This is a public problem. Handle it through legislation.
But, Mr. Raskin, when you say the labor movement, you mean the labor movement as a whole. I quite agree with you. What I find disturbing is that the Teamsters themselves have been rather cynical about the Becks and the Hoffas.
Yes, well, I think that is the... I think that the reasons for the overall failure of the labor movement to do this self-policing job, after all, if a democratic society is going to work, it has to be on the assumption of responsibility by all of us and by each of our institutions. And
Excuse me.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, Mr. Atwood, I think you wanted to comment.
Well, I wanted to comment on something Dr. Niebuhr said about public and private morality. I think one does affect the other. For example, when people feel that their government officials are in on some kind of a take, they feel, well, if they're getting theirs, I'm going to get mine. When they see a chairman of regulatory commissions accepting favors and hospitality from people who are supposed to regulate, Sherman Adams, many of these instances have taken place in Washington. They feel that, well, I'll pad my expense account, too. They have less compunction about cheating on their income tax, which is becoming widespread, because they feel that this is a general accepted practice. The people at the top are doing it, therefore, why shouldn't I do it? So I think the public morality does affect...
You're right, but Mr. Edward, I don't like to be an optimist when I'm supposed to be a pessimist, but I would say that taken as a whole... despite all these illustrations of Sherman Adams and Goldfein, that our public morality, or let us say our political morality, is rather higher than it was in the past. It may be a crisis now, but if you think that we fought two world wars with minimal scandals in the financial details, much less than the Spanish War and the Civil War.
Let's stay with that a moment. Are we any worse, at least in the area of public morality, than we ever were? The political instances, bribery was, after all, the standard thing in 1890. It's not now.
We had the Tweed Gang running
the Tweed Gang.
New York City.
Or business practices. Uh-huh. Adulterating food was standard in 1900. It's not now. Are you quarreling with that approach, Mr. Atwood?
No, I think there's less overt corruption, certainly, in Washington. The favors are not done for bribes, but yeah. I think there's a confusion, certainly, there has been, between a government official's sense of public trust and for example, let's take the regulatory commissions. They feel that they should be doing favors for friends. They're not doing it because of any bribe, but it's a failure to understand what public trust is. It's a moral confusion, I think.
But is that new? Isn't it true that in the days of the robber barons, government was regarded as really an agency and a servant of all these trusts that were built up?
Yes, perhaps there's more candor today.
Perhaps there's more concern about things that were much more flagrant in the past. And maybe that's a wholesome rather than a pessimistic development. As you well know, as an old newspaper man, you create a crime wave by writing about it, by talking about it. And it may be that the level of crime is not any greater, and it perhaps is even less.
Well, are you suggesting that we create sin by talking about it?
I think that the extent to which we are concerned about it is a wholesome thing. And that sometimes in our eagerness to do things about problems that are genuine problems, that we create a focus in which it appears that we are suddenly being engulfed by something that has always been with us and perhaps is not nearly as acute as we feel it is.
You know, I feel that I don't want to be complacent by my optimism, but I think Mr. Raskin is right about that. These are the perennial corruptions of power and government, and on the whole, the American government on the federal level, not on the municipal level, on the federal level, with the exception of the Grant administration and the Harding administration, has been fairly good. I think the other points raised in his moral crisis,
yes.
And that is the family, the cheating, the infidelity in family relationship is very much more important than the question of dishonesty, although I
yes.
agree to his
Let's get to that. Now, you men seem to be agreeing that in the area of public morality, probably either things are pretty much the same, are better, or we can't tell anyhow. Let's move to this private area. And, for example, the statements, Mr. Atwood, in that article of yours, where you detect what seems to me rather much a collapse of private morality, a feeling that anything which is not openly illegal and does not directly hurt somebody
is
okay.
Well, this is a very important point, yes. Wherever we went in making this survey, we found that there was a kind of a change in our code of ethics. In other words, people felt not too much of a compunction about breaking a law if, A, they disapproved of the law, such as prohibition or some traffic violations and all that. B, if violation was part of accepted business practice, for example, expense account padding and so forth. Or thirdly, most importantly, if it doesn't hurt another individual.
Yeah.
I mean, a person will not cheat his corner grocer, but he has less feeling about the supermarket, this being a corporation. No damage is done to another person.
The point that you make about the corner grocer and the supermarket, I think, is important. I wonder whether one could draw the conclusion that part of the breakdown of morality, and I don't know whether it's private or public, is the anonymity and the complexity of an urban civilization against the simpler civilization. You don't want to cheat a person, but you cheat a corporation. Isn't that part of the, perhaps the nemesis of a commercial society? When you recognize that Weber's thesis was that a commercial society only developed as people got enough of the so-called Puritan virtues, honesty, thrift, and industry, to establish it, to establish the credit relationships that are necessary. Now, this commercial society has gone into a technical society with this anonymity, and it's broken down. I detect a kind of a nemesis in this.
Something like hitting the jackpot on the telephone, coin telephone, and suddenly you get 30 or 40 cents will drop out when you feel, well, that's, of course, my dividend from my constant use of the telephone. But, of course, if you don't get your dime back when you fail to complete the call, then you denounce this great trust that is stripping you of your property.
The same is true of the government. The government becoming more and more impersonal and remote. You don't feel that you're really hurting anybody by chiseling a little bit on an income tax.
Well, could we document this very specifically, again, to come back to your expertness, Mr. Raskin? In the field of private morality, what has collapsed vis-a-vis the labor unions?
Well, let me just take the case that Mr. Niebuhr was talking about, the Teamsters.
Yeah.
I think the prevailing attitude that has been demonstrated over and over again of the rank-and-file Teamster is, I don't care what Jimmy Hoffa is accused of doing as long as I don't see any evidence that he's hurting me. He's delivered for me. My paycheck is good. We've got a good welfare program. We've got a good pension program. This man is doing all right for me. And what do I care what he does? Whose business is it of anybody else? And Jimmy Hoffa approaches his responsibility in that same way. And unfortunately, the employers generally in the trucking industry are perfectly content to do business with Jimmy Hoffa. And employers generally, I find, take the view, well, he was interested in a buck. What's so bad about that? And Walter Reuther, who is certainly, in terms of morality, a much more enlightened person, is the ogre because he's trying to change the basic rules of society.
The basic rules. Yeah. Now, that's what is deficient in just talking about morality, because Hoffa is presumably, from our position, more immoral, certainly, than Walter Reuther, who is an idealist. But he changes the rules. Now, there you get into a political morality.
Yeah.
And the complacency of America doesn't permit that. While it is complacent about the cheating, the dishonesty.
Well, now, to take this and to try to move to the question of where we are going with respect to this morals question. Mr. Atwood, you in your article and orally here keep suggesting that the values are changing, particularly in this area of private morality, and you say we're moving toward a group morality. That is, you can do anything that your particular group considers all right. For example, like cheating on the income tax. Now, Mr. Niebuhr, you're our authority on sin here. Is this a morality? Does it make any sense to you?
Well, it makes sense, but I don't think that's new. It's say that a small group has its own standards from the standpoint of which it defies a larger group, whether it be the nation or the community of nations. That's an old thing. I remember that during the war, some very honest Vermont farmers cheated on gasoline because they thought this was Russell's war. And they got away with it because the community agreed with them. That wasn't a private defiance of community standards. It was the community defiance of general standards. That's what we got in the race issue. All this problem of segregation, desegregation, what we've got there is that A small community devoted to the so-called Southern way of life defies the standards, or what we call the standards of humanity, of a common humanity. That's not a new thing. That's an old thing, but it's got a very tragic form now, because the Negroes were on the march and simply insisting on being regarded as human beings.
But these people, these Southerners of which you speak, are by and large more church-going, for example, than in other parts of the country. They speak the Bible Belt. Isn't there torment going on? How do they reconcile their feeling about segregation with their profession of Christianity?
Well, of course, that's a big question that I think church people ought to be very disquieted about, because, as a matter of fact, I don't think the church is quite as bad, and as many of its critics say, not as good as it thinks it is, because the church, despite its so-called Christian standards and human standards, has been, on the whole, an instrument of the Southern way of life. Although I must say that a lot of heroic parsons that I know of have proven that there is some conscience in regard to
it. But aren't we using this word group idea of morality in a couple of different senses here? And Mr. Atwood, I took you to mean that what is growing up now is a kind of sense, let us say, in the business community, yeah, and a sense in the labor community, and a sense in this, that, and the other community, that we have our own rules. This is a little different from the whole Southern group. Was that what you were going to comment
on,
Mr.?
Well, it seems to me that one of the things... First, I just wanted to say, to finish out the point that Mr. Atwood and Mr. Niebuhr were discussing, that it seems to me one of the wholesome developments, one of the signs that we are not quite as lost as Mr. Steinbeck professes to feel that we are, is that there is beginning to be an uprising, first of all, led by the Negro students in the South, and having an enormous amount of public support throughout the country. So there is some moral response. But the thing that does disturb me about whether we can really pull out of this or whether we have a group approach, I think that one of the things that's fundamental to our dilemma today is that we have been rooted in the notion that you have to have some kind of financial and material incentives, and that the more and more you pile up a material wealth, this is the better off you will be. And so you find we have the problem of what to do about race relations in the country, what to do about unemployment, what to do about any of these other things that are wrong. And we keep saying to ourselves, not we ought to do these things because they're right, but Khrushchev has threatened that he will do this, yep, that, and the other, and we must mobilize for this. We're afraid to face up to the fact that we are basically a decent people, that we are concerned about things. We're apologetic about doing the right
things.
People
are afraid of expressing moral indignation, I think.
It's not a great tolerance.
I think in the unfortunate Van Doren case, this was displayed very well, because people sympathized with this fellow. Well, it was entertainment, and what would you have done in his position? There seemed to be no thinking beyond all of this, to the point of, well, he did lie.
You cite a man, Mr. Atwood, whose group influences were so powerful that he did not cheat on his income tax, but said he did, because in his group the mode was to cheat on your income tax. Now, where is this decent fellow, though, Mr. Raskin? As you paint him, Mr. Atwood,
well,
he cheats in school while he's growing up, he cheers Charlie Van Doren, then he cheats on his expense account, and et cetera, all the way through.
Well, I think it would be fatuous to pretend that we don't have these tendencies and that they are enormously widespread, and I think the disturbing thing is that too much now the pressure of the community is to identify with this as the right thing to do, so that we feel, well, it's a sucker, you're being naive, being stupid. It's just not the thing to do to say, I believe in what's right and decent, and I practice. You begin to feel it's sanctimonious and
disquieting. Well, to some degree, this is a perennial problem, that there is a group pressure and that creates standards. On the other hand, thank goodness, there are individuals who defy their group for the sake of honesty, etc. I remember a pre-war British ambassador, whose name I've forgotten, making a point about this. He said, I've served His Majesty's government through all cultures and climes, with all kinds of standards, but I found one significant uniformity in all of them, and that is that they all distinguished between an honest and a dishonest man, honest and dishonest man, whatever their standards were. Now, thank God that there are some individuals who have standards beyond the standards of the group. That's, I think, you wouldn't deny that, Mr. Atwood, that you have
country.
That. They may have some other group standards that defy the group, the commercial group standards, for instance, spiritual, moral standards. But there is that leaven in society now, as there always has been, I think.
But who is giving the group moral direction? I mean, is the church? There was a time, it seems to me, when the church was considered the source of what was right and wrong of moral. But today, there's less than the people go through the motions. They go to church. They belong to churches. But do they really accept the teachings of the church as a guide to their personal morality?
That's a question, of course, and on the whole, they don't do as much, although in the race issue, the church, with all of its failings, has been, both on the Negro and the white side, quite a resource, and particularly a church that liberals don't like very well, the Catholic Church. Take the group morality of the Catholic Church on the race issue, where it's a monolithic structure, absolute standards simply say that race...
Mr. Niebuhr, how about the Catholic, Protestant, or Jewish church on the subject of cheating in school and padding your expense account, etc., or supporting Jimmy Hoffa and so forth?
Well,
what about this area?
Well, in that area, I don't think... Perhaps they're irrelevant to that area. That's probably the trouble, is that the church is irrelevant to this area because it deals just with personal things, more obvious things, and I don't think the church would ever condone cheating.
Well, isn't there a great gulf, though, between our preachment? Certainly, the church, all the precepts of the church are directed at the elimination of just these things we object to. Unhappily, there is no translation of that.
Well, what I'm
similarly,
wondering...
our national impulses are all good, but they don't get carried out the way we'd like to see them.
What I'm wondering here as we race toward the end of this, about that statement of Mr. Atwood at the beginning, are we moving into an era when the old values of our churches, of our society, and so forth, no longer fit the society?
Well, I don't think I don't think you can answer that question simply, because the values of honesty, integrity, and fidelity always fit. But
does honesty mean the same thing in any significant sense?
I think so. But when you get into the higher questions of public morality, the nuclear dilemma, there one has to say that the old black and white theory of right and wrong isn't adequate. We've got ambiguities in the nuclear dilemma, which the church and all the idealists don't really meet, because we have got an ambiguous field of right and wrong. The only way you could solve that...
Very
sure.
Unfortunately, Mr. Niebuhr, I see the signal to close for a program thoroughly in the tradition of the open mind. Thank you, Mr. A.H. Raskin, Mr. Reinhold Niebuhr, and Mr. William Atwood.